Today we are talking about United States policy. One of the questions I always get is people say, what is the United States government doing about what's happening in South Africa? Or what can the United States government do in relation to South Africa? Now, if you've just arrived today or you missed the other sessions, and you know, don't despair, and you know, you'll catch up, then we will just give you a very brief presentation, and then we will open it up for questions and answers. So, Molefe, when I am here.
Okay, last time we left at 48, and then we'll move on from that. I'll briefly give you,
hold on. When we say for those who are coming, I just realized that some people may have come today. So you say left it at 48 from where? What we did was we talked about the history of South Africa, how it did come about, and up to 48 when the policy of apartheid became law. So if you have a question on how did this all begin, don't feel left out that we are now talking post 48. So you can always ask and say, how did this all come about? So please don't feel shy. Go ahead.
Okay. In 48, the nationalist power came into power in South Africa. I mean, the nationalist government came into power into South Africa. So right after that, that period, that's when things started to move in the other direction, now enforcing the whole institutionalizing apartheid. And I can briefly tell you from my experience was we lived in Sophiatown, where Sophiatown was a little suburb outside Johannesburg, and right across the street it was a white suburb. And in 1955, that's when the Resettlement Act started, and I was about 8 years. And we were moved to Soweto, which is a southwestern townships at the south of Johannesburg, and Dumisani did tell you a little bit about Soweto. So, and everybody who was black and lived in Sophiatown, we were all moved to Soweto. And those moves were, it's not that you would have somebody to come and move you, the army moved in overnight and the police. And they didn't care whether you packed or you didn't pack. And you were all hauled in a truck and driven to a remote area about 14, 13 miles out of Johannesburg. Now this is exclusive black area. This is what Soweto is today. And getting there was no running water, toilet facilities, all the toilets were outside. It was dirt floors, asbestos roofing. This is very important because we may touch into the health aspect of it. All the houses in Soweto were asbestos roofing. And no floors, the floors were all dead, and we had just moved in. And the important aspect of it, of separate development, was when we lived in Sophiatown, some of us, I didn't know Dumisani was a Zulu or a Metswana or somebody's a Venda. The whole thing was by moving to Soweto is when we realized that the ethnic grouping was now taking place. We were all put into different zones. That the Zulus will go to zone 4, the Tswanas will go to zone 1. So that's when the division of the African people by ethnic grouping started. This was purposely done. And again, the aspect was moving into Bantu education. Dr. Verwoerd, who was the prime minister then, he made a statement as the prime minister of the country that don't teach blacks any sciences or mathematics because they don't have anywhere to use it, and all the blacks should be taught how to read and write. So it was to prepare you to be just a servant. And all those things started coming into play. Some of us, we didn't know what was going on. And then right after that, that's when now all the females were required to go and apply for a reference book, which is what the male carries. And I showed mine the other day, I didn't bring it. Now, with that reference book, there were so many things involved because My father was Venda, and my mother, she was Tswana. And in my family, my two brothers fall under my father's ethnic grouping, and my sister and my brother, they fall under my mother's. So we were divided right there. And then when we started going to school, and the schools were divided by your mother tongue, well, by mother tongue, I mean, if you're Zulu, you specifically have to go to a Zulu-speaking school. And my school was about 5 miles away, and my brother was about 100 yards away from where we were. So that's when the wheels of apartheid were working. And people were not happy about it. All the movements were there, but there was nothing you could do. And there were the police and the army 24 hours. There was no transportation, so people who had to work in the cities, the government sometimes provided transportation till things started to fall in place. Then the aspect, going back now, having the overview of what was happening. Late 50s, all the unions were disbanded. So the government collaborated with the industries that they should discourage any unions. Now this is taking effect to the economy part of the country. So the unions were banned, and finally there was no union at all. So you had no presentation as a worker, and you had no voice. And that's when, if you need a job, you had 72 hours to find another job, and if your ethnic grouping is different, you were moved out of Johannesburg. So this was preparing people with a homeland policy. And families were getting divided, and jobs were essential. Some people always belonged to unions, and all of a sudden we realized, some of us, that this one comes from a different ethnic grouping. So all those things started to take place. And coming to the present, you have to be very much aware that South Africa, the black businessmen don't even constitute 2% of the national stockholding in the nation, in South Africa. And the other thing is that with that 2%, they don't even have a saying whether the economy goes into shambles or not. They are not making a dent regarding the economy in the country. So given those aspects, and we have your policies here that change with administrations, and then we move into people who say, if we divest in South Africa, it's going to hurt the blacks. It really doesn't hurt the blacks. Unemployment in South Africa has been going to 25% of the blacks. It's been that way, and it's been going up. So it's nothing new to the people, the African people in South Africa. And by then, when I mean 25% of the unemployment in South Africa, this 25% doesn't include the colors nor the Indians. It's directed to the African people. This is where they are the majority, and this is the control. And most of them, they don't even appear in the statistics, because you get arrested and you are shipped to the homeland. So you are a foreigner in your own country half the time. So it comes to constructive engagement. What the US with administrations, with the current administrations, things were going this way, and Reagan comes in, there's constructive engagement, we cannot pull out. And issues like that, we always confronted with one thing or the other, and the people in the country, really, they all for sanctions, complete pullout of South Africa, US businesses in South Africa. Now, what some of the companies are doing, Coca-Cola for one, they pull out by sell, but they do sell the subsidiary to a company in South Africa. So that really doesn't do anything. And for the country, because you're still going to have Coke. And they're still going to have their bit of a shareholder. It's a subsidiary now, it's no longer a holding. And to highlight this, I can give you an incident. It's even in a case history of some business schools, the Polaroid. Polaroid pulled out in South Africa in the late 70s for the fact they were providing film and the technology for the South African government to monitor the blacks more efficiently. And somebody found out that in Boston, we're getting all this in South Africa, and he didn't agree. And Frank and Nash was the distributor for Polaroid. And it became a big issue. That's when we got to the Sullivan Principles, and that's when Polaroid pulled up. And then I let Dumisani take off from there.
Well, when we talk about US foreign policy, and can you see here? Can you see? Hello, hello. If you don't see, that's okay. I'll tell you what it is. US foreign policy has four pillars. US foreign policy is not based on the fact whether you like black people or white people or whatever. It's simply based on what can America get from you if you're not American. I know you might not like to hear that, but it's the truth. That's how U.S. foreign policy is based. It's among its pillars, the diplomatic side, the military side, the economic side, the cultural side. There are other little sides to this, but these are the four pillars. So if you go to the State Department, those guys in dark suits and nice white button-down shirts are divided into basically four units that are the diplomatic corps, and you know, the military guys, and the economic folks, and the culture. These are the four ties that still relate to South Africa. Well, what do we have on the diplomatic? Well, we have an ambassador, an American ambassador in South Africa, who's based in Pretoria. There are three consul generals' offices in Durban, Cape Town, and what have you. And under this diplomatic cover, there are the other faceless folks known as the CIA. And they operate here undercover. And we are not here to discuss whether they should be there or shouldn't be there. That's not the question tonight. But it's simply to tell you that they have all these folks who are there, including people who provide libraries. And, you know, I used to read the books at American libraries, you know, you have the U.S. Information Center. Military, the United States government believes and says that they don't sell arms to South Africa. Well, that's half true, in the sense that although they don't sell a whole tank to South Africa, when Reagan came into office, he said, well, we can sell them spare parts. There's nothing wrong in selling them spare parts. So it's like saying, I won't sell you a whole Ford or Chevrolet, I can sell you parts, right? So Monday you buy two wheels, on Tuesday you buy another two wheels, Wednesday you buy an engine, the next day you buy wipers, the next day you buy this, and eventually you make your own car. You know, so there's a military attaché in South Africa who is American as much. By the way, the South Africans reciprocate on the same thing. So, you know, for every ranking officer the United States has in South Africa, they have the same thing too. So the South Africans too have their own intelligence people. And here, they also have the military intelligence people, the national security folks, who are even higher than these folks in terms of intelligence. You never know about them because you can't even discuss them. And you know, the economic ties are the companies, the United States, even though businessmen will tell you, and there might be people in business here, they will always profess to you that we are independent private businesses, we're corporations, we have nothing to do with the government. But American businesses serve the interest of U.S. foreign policy. Okay, the question is, how do they do that? Well, the way they do it is, if Reagan says there's a country we don't like, and the businesses turn around and not like that country, right? And take Nicaragua, or take Cuba. I mean, you know, Reagan doesn't like Nicaragua, American businesses won't go there. And you know, Reagan likes South Africa, they will go there and claim, well, we're there to save people. In essence, I'm simply saying that if you look at the way businesses operate. They eventually operate in the same way that fits U.S. policy of the day. Now, they will deny that. I've been in many forums with them, and I've met with some of them who sound more concerned than Mother Teresa, but you know, they are all, they'll deny it, they get very angry if you mention it, because they are private individuals and what have you. But in fact, the truth is that they serve that policy because they operate in it. Culturally, if you tell musicians until fairly recently, 5 years ago, if you told them that they end up serving the policies of the U.S. government, they would get angry at you and say, well, I have my contract, you know, with the Atlantic Records, and I sing my song in my house and record, I have nothing to do. But in fact, they do. I mean, you know, they when the U.S. government and the Soviet Union started warming up in the past year or so, didn't you see a lot of musicians suddenly having concerts in Moscow and Leningrad, and everybody who has a guitar now wants to go have a gig in Moscow somewhere, right? And you know, and the question is, why didn't they have a gig before? And you know, it's because without anybody telling them, they say, aha, that's not where we're gonna go. This is important because my friends here who saw Sun City last night with me until 2 a.m., we're up till 2 a.m., we're watching, a group of musicians were saying they won't perform in South Africa. See, South Africa, the South African government knows that nobody likes it. Everybody thinks they are bad, which in fact is an understatement. But, you know, they think they are bad. So what do? They get American groups, pay them more money. When Frank Sinatra performed in South Africa, he had 3 concerts and was paid over $6 million. He doesn't make that at Las Vegas. But the point is not whether Frank Sinatra sings or not. It comes down to Americans. You know, American people as such, and when we talk about the media on Saturday, you, again, you might not like this. Holden is not a place where you're gonna like everything, right? And that's why you're here. And if you think you are here, it's the wrong place, then you wasted your money, right? But the point is that Americans in general, and maybe you folks are more aware of it, Americans in general have trouble when they are faced with a country overseas that drinks Coca-Cola, drives in GM cars, listen to Frank Sinatra's music, and you know, and suddenly somebody comes and says, that country is not good. And you know, they say, well, why are they not good? I mean, they are like us. And you know, they like our music. They like our cars, they like our product. What's wrong with them? And you know, can't you just try and fix them up? Because they're like us. Now, if you have a country that doesn't listen to your music, that doesn't follow these things, and then somebody says they are not a good country, say, oh yeah, for sure. You know, I knew they were not even good. You know, they don't even drink Coca-Cola. I know you folks don't say that, you were way ahead of those folks. But I can tell you, you know, that I talk in colleges and I get students who talk about our, you know, to give you an idea, there's a newspaper that makes money on that called USA Today. You know, buy a copy of USA Today, they talk about us, you know, us, and you know, even though it's used for US, but you know, it's, they always have these stories about us, and it's true. People tend to talk in those terms. So what we are saying then about South Africa, we are saying cut all these ties. You know, wipe out all these ties. And of course, people get very worried when you say, start saying, wipe out all these. The economic ties, for instance, to start with. Okay, I told you, the cultural ties is not because they really care what song Frank Sinatra or whoever they pay to come to South Africa to sing. It's because people remember that Michael Jackson's victory tour went to this country, that country, that country, that country, right? I mean, you know, it's when you sit down and you say Michael Jackson, oh, he just came from a victory tour. He stopped in Japan, he stopped in this island, he stopped in that island. And people, when they say that, they tend to feel good, they feel warm. You know, here's a country that accepted our superstar. You know, then they are the good guys. South Africa knows that. And you know, so that's why they pay these folks to come and sing there. So I think we have, to a large extent, succeeded in making it almost impossible for some of these major musicians to perform there. And you know, they went to Stevie Wonder. For instance, to give you an example, they went to Stevie Wonder and guaranteed him $10 million if he could come to South Africa for anything. And Stevie Wonder called a press conference and said, you can keep your money. And you know what they did? When 2 years ago, you remember the movie called The Woman in Red? And okay, I think one of the songs is I Just Called to Say I Love You by Stevie Wonder. Well, he won an Oscar for it. And when he accepted the Oscar, you know, like they always thank my manager, my everybody, and finally, as the last sentence, he said, and I'm accepting this in the name of Nelson Mandela. He didn't explain who Nelson Mandela was, and I'm sure a billion people who were watching probably didn't know at the time who Nelson Mandela was. The very next day, the government ruled that any music by Stevie Wonder was banned from South Africa. Why? Because Stevie Wonder had done what they spent millions to do to try and promote it culturally and do that. Economically, companies don't go to South Africa because they love black people. I mean, you know, if GM loves black people, why don't they start in Detroit or Seattle? You know, 10,000 miles to love black people. But when you hear people, these company executives, when you hear them talk, oh, we in South Africa, we provide jobs for black people. They love us 10,000 miles away. They don't like us when we're next door. And you know, they are not in South Africa because they love black people. They are in South Africa because it's profitable. Why is it profitable? It's profitable because of apartheid. Listen, I wasn't in this country, but I hear from going around, I met a professor who told me that during the days of slavery, there were more millionaires in the southern United States than there were in the northern United States. Why? Because of slavery. Hell, you didn't need tractors. You know, you had human beings you could use as slaves. And you know, and after the slavery period, the economy of the South changed. The North sort of rose economically and whatever. So the companies are not in South Africa because they love black people. They are there because it's profitable. Why is it profitable? It's profitable because of apartheid. So don't buy this whole thing about, oh, you know, aren't they providing jobs? Slavery was a full employment opportunity, the slave trade. And you know, look, American companies have never gone anywhere or into any neighborhood. Think about it. You don't have to go 10,000 miles. Think about it. Where are the jobs in this country? They're in the Sun Belt, right? Why? Because they don't like negotiating with unions. And you know, you have unions, oh, you will leave your town. You suddenly elect a mayor they don't like, they move out of town. I mean, they are trying to get Reagan not even to sign this bill that gives people 60 days, you know. So you see, listen, anybody who's ever done business 101, when you go to Milton Friedman or any of those folks for business 101, they tell you, if I give you a dollar to invest, you bring back 10 cents, or if you are a very good businessman, bring another $5 back. And you know, but the point is that every company, every entity is in business to make money. So they are not even in South Africa to develop the South African economy, for that matter. No, they get the racists to say, we'll oppress black people for you and give them to you as cheap labor. They say, hey, we'll give you money, we'll pay you. People always say to me, how can Coca-Cola support apartheid? You know how they support apartheid? In a very direct way. They pay taxes to the South African government. There is no way you support anybody other than by paying taxes directly to them. And you know what, for you taxpayers like me, come April 15th, they deduct those taxes they paid from South Africa. From their, what do you call the form we sign, you know? Whatever form we sign for tax, and you can see I pay taxes very sporadically, right? And you know, but you know, they deduct those taxes, and that's a direct funding of it. Look, if I say that I am against pornography, I shouldn't pay taxes to pornography or to the pimps or whatever the institution is for pornography. So economically, they're not there just because they don't even love white South Africans. You know, the Afrikaners are dumb. They say, you know, we'll give you black people. They say, oh yeah, sure, let's explore it. Because think, look at this. Every shirt you wear, it's made where? In South Korea. Why are they making it in South Korea? Why are they not making it on 7th Avenue in New York? Because in South Korea, they can get South Korean women, pay them a dollar every 2 weeks, mm-hmm. and then I make sure they're and if South Korea stops that, they're going to move to another country. Mm-hmm. They are called multinationals. You know what that means? We go wherever we can make a buck. Mm-hmm. You know? They are telling the Soviets now. They are telling the Soviets, hey, you know, we can give you popcorn, man. You know, give us popcorn machine. And you know, but you have to pay us in US dollars to make money. And we're not here to question whether companies should make money or not. But I do question when a Church of Christ suddenly gets trapped into this. You see, because when the missionaries taught us about the gospel, they said, you see one thing I didn't do? I didn't put the church here. Mm-hmm. But some of these churches belong here. You know, there's another wing of US foreign policy that is very churchy. Because you have churches that invest in apartheid that are right here. You could have a little line here and say churches. Mm-hmm. Because they do exactly the same thing. They go to South Africa and start apologizing for the church. Oh, you know, those tribes are going to kill each other. You know, and Reagan comes up and says, oh, yeah, those tribes are going to... You know, it's for those of you who are new, I don't use the word tribe. You know, because I haven't heard of the Norwegian tribe, the French tribe, the Italian tribe. We had an exercise last night with my friends, and I said to these 18-year-old kids, I said, I'll say the word tribe, what do you see? Everybody said, well, I see people who are living together, being led by some. We said, what color they are? Well, they are not white. Do you know any tribe that's white? If you do, tell me. Military, and I know this is the dangerous thing. You know what, Nixon? I love Nixon more than I love Reagan. And you know, I know you folks might not want to remember Nixon, but I like Nixon. You know what happened? U.S. foreign service, for those of you who were in the Navy, when U.S. ships used to dock in South Africa, when the the enlisted men get off the ship, they used to come out in separate lines. The whites first, and the blacks would come out and be restricted. And the U.S. government tolerated until Nixon, black sailors in South Africa decided, hey, we're going to take over this country if you're going to do this to us. And, you know, Nixon said, no more. So no American ships docked there because of that. And, you know, and Reagan tried for the first 3 years to make ships to go there. Never mind that, you know, they sold them. But the military ties, even though they're not there, they are now selling something that will get the soldiers there quicker than anything. That's communism. You see, one thing about communism is that it's like the word racism. You know, if I say you're a racist, I don't have to explain what I mean. You know that? I don't have to explain. Everybody sort of understands. Oh, he's racist. Oh, yeah, we know that. Same thing, if I say you're communist, I don't have to explain. You know, we're just us sitting away from you because there's something called communism. Well, if it means that for fighting for freedom you have to be a communist, so be it. They called Martin Luther King in this country a communist. Yeah. I mean, I read it, I used to send a page. They called him a communist when he started wanting to walk from one town to the next. Oh, the communists have got it. And that is dangerous because I tell you, I bet you 2 cents, you will be sending, you know, the airborne soldiers to land in those nice parachutes and landing in South Africa. They won't be coming to save black people. The diplomatic ties, this is what we've been calling. You know, why do you need diplomatic ties? You know what the Reagan diplomatic corps does in South Africa, and this happens in other countries too, every July 4th to take a holiday. The local diplomatic staff in any country, whether I've seen this happen in Switzerland and that, they have a July 4 party, usually it's a barbecue or whatever, and you know, and they invite black and white South Africans. In South Africa, the Reagan State, the diplomatic corps, they have separate parties for blacks and whites. That's why Bishop Tutu said, I don't want to be seen next to any of those folks, because that would be something. Well, the question comes before I shut up. Why is this policy like this? Well, if you really want to know why is this policy like this, think about why is this policy
The same for black people in this country.
Well, you say, well, but black people are fellow Americans. Well,
you know, the irony is that in 1945, the United Nations, and I know some folks don't like the United Nations, but it's there, whether we like it or not. The United Nations put in a document on human rights, which is, you know, affirms the human rights of every individual in the world. Guess who drew the document? South Africa. South Africa wrote that document. And, you know, the United States refused to sign that document because, you know, they had their own racism here. At least they were honest. And, you know, all the presidents from Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson, even with his Great Society and what have you, Johnson, Nixon, they didn't sign it until Jimmy Carter. And I remember Jesse Helms screaming high heaven that the United States was going to sign any of those. South Africa side actually sat and wrote in San Francisco here. They sat and wrote the document. And we have argued that until you see, you can't suddenly go overseas. And you know, charity begins at home. And to show you with this administration, to give you an illustration, President Reagan has been in power now 8 years, right? When last, now think about this, I know you guys watch TV. When last did you see Ronald Reagan on TV with a black person on any issue? Think about it. Just think. Except the black person with Secret Service or something. Well, now, maybe now with General Powell who's taken over as national security. But think if General Powell took over now after the Holy North. But when, do you ever remember seeing President Reagan with a black person? And you know, I as a journalist, I always like to read the fine print. You know, each time the White House has a dinner, they always publish the guest list. And you know, and it's always in the finest of the fine print. And I every time they do, I always do an exercise and read the names and call the library and try to compare how many of them are black. There's never been any dinner in the White House that has had more than three black people. And those names recur over and over. I can send you the actual newspaper. Why is that important? Well, let me give you another thing. Because this is important. And now you're talking about being a multicultural church, so we go there and we come back to the congregation. You fit the missing pieces in your congregation. Every year, when there's a World Series of baseball. You see, I'm telling you these little things. I know people say to me, you're petty, why do you have to? Because it's the little things that matter. Every year when there's a World Series game or a Super Bowl, the winning team always receives a call from Reagan. 90% of the time he doesn't know he's talking to, but he says, okay. Every year. But you know what happened? The last Super Bowl, for the first time in the country, a black quarterback leads the team to the Super Bowl. I mean, a very historic moment.
Yeah.
Reagan doesn't make the call.
Uh-oh.
Now, I know you folks are saying he's being petty, but to kids, I have a son who's seen these phone calls and looks forward to them with glee because he says, I want to see how many mistakes he makes. And Reagan doesn't call. But you see, to you folks, we could say, well, you know, we are cultured here. We could say, well, you know, maybe he was busy and he was tired. But to the young folks out there and to many old folks like me out there, that is an omission that is what's the English word there? I'm thinking in a Zulu word, but you know, in line, but there's another big word that's going to lay on you, but it's gonna, in line with what Reagan does in terms of black people. When Desmond Tutu received the Nobel Prize, he received congratulations for every country except the Soviet Union and the good old USA. Reagan couldn't bring himself to doing that until people in Congress said, hey, you're not going to even say congratulate. I mean, it's done by routine, by a secretary. It's not even done by a president. You know, some secretary down the hall
sees something and says, well, the president should send a card on this, and send a card.
That's right.
I mean, Reagan doesn't get all little, but that's scary because even the 10th person from away from the president is so in tune with them that they know exactly that this is the way. You see, how then can this president, who doesn't care about people of color in this country, suddenly love us 10,000 miles away? You see where the problem is?
That's a big problem.
And you know, it's not because. I realize you're probably hearing these things for the first time and you never thought they were important, but they go a long way. Because until this administration, look, let me give you another two examples. I could call you. Or in fact, if you go down the hall, I'm a newspaper junkie, go down the hall. Let me give you the first thing and then tell you why you need to go down the hall when you have the chance. President Reagan has been in office for 8 years. You've known, you know about the NAACP, right? You may have forgotten it, but you know, it's been there since 1909, so it's not going to be easy to forget it. In 9 years, President Reagan has never met with Ben Hooks from the NAACP. Never. I mean, there is no president. No president has been in office. Now, there's no law that he says he has to meet with Ben Hooks.
Right.
But what message does it send to people? The Urban League, John Jacob. I mean, 8 years is never meant to, but you know what's interesting? Talk about go down the hall. I went there to go look for baseball scores. What's the big story? George Bush was invited to address the Urban League. He said, no, I'm not going there. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. So you see what's in store in us if he wins? I'm going home if he wins. But you know, the point I'm trying to say about foreign policy, I know when we talk foreign policy, we expect to discuss big policy and whatever. It's the little things. So this church, my church, I'm a Methodist. This church, this American Lutheran Church or Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, has investments in South Africa. So in other words, whether you like it or not, the Lutheran Church finds itself under fine print under here. So does my Methodist Church. And folks in South Africa sit back and look at this and say, diplomats, they are there. Military, we know they are there, even though they can get spent. Under economics, my God, we even see our fellow Lutherans and Methodists and Anglicans. What's this? And you know, the irony is that there are alternative investments that are prudent as required by U.S. law, that are safe as required by U.S. law, that have nothing to do with South Africa. So this, if next time you think about U.S. policy, this is what we're trying. Unfortunately, these changes can only come through Congress. You say but how are you going to argue that Congress passed the bills like the bills that are pending? You know, because you see where we are. We don't have to show somewhere here. I mean, it really doesn't make any sense. I mean, these guys are gonna make, you know, people, especially the trustees. I'll sit here so that we can have a discussion. Trustees say, we are required by law to make money. Oh yeah, sure. You know, there's a law called fiduciary responsibility. The law says, if I contribute 10 cents to you for my pension,
yes, sir,
you should invest it prudently and make money. Mm-hmm. But you know what? There are tons of pension funds that say to their investment manager, we don't buy cigarettes companies. We don't invest in alcohol companies. Others go further, say we don't invest in environment companies. When it comes to South Africa, they say, well, we have to make money. So why do we have to invest in racism? I mean, if we're in the business of making money, why don't we put it in pornography or cocaine? You know, we could make a hell of a lot of money. And you know, then they say, well, we can't go in there. Well, I know you might have heard this before, but I thought I'll just, in this context, when you look at this, you begin to see the picture. This, by the way, This stays whether it's Republicans or whatever. This is a constant. The folks who do this, they never get elected. And you never know their names. And they do this. And it dictates all over the world. You can look, to give you an example, look at, I think the Soviet Union example is interesting. Suddenly when Reagan warmed up to them, you saw this cultural thing being activated. They went and danced, right? Businessmen met with Gorbachev at his place. You remember when Gorbachev was in Washington and what have you? The military guy. So Kaluchi is in the Soviet Union today. See, I listen to the radio at 4 a.m. listening for baseball scores. So I find And you know, the diplomatic thing, and you know, they're talking about building a new Moscow embassy. So you see, there's an example. When they start hating you, there's no diplomatic ties with Nicaragua. I mean, they say it will hurt black people in South Africa when they do that. Why doesn't it hurt the Nicaraguan people? And you know, so why would, you see, they remove this in Nicaragua. Yes, the military, they have our founding fathers' contras, right? They found them here on this one. They remove this one. They remove this one. So you know, you can, you see, Nicaragua, they don't have these three components. They have this one military using the contract. So you draw this and think of any country, and you'll see how it works. Well, why don't we take questions? Because I have to go sing with the Zulu Heaven the Choir owner. Please. Oh, yeah, please. Just speak up because I don't see.
Not a question, but a comment. As far as policy is concerned, Reagan didn't think too much about Panamanians when he embargoed that country to the extent that he took away their money.
You mean which country, sir?
Panama.
Oh, Panama, right.
Okay. Right. But what's in Panama that the United States has a finger on that they're about to lose? The Panama Canal. And when it came out that this guy was in drug running with Oliver North, all of a sudden, the United States had to put their foot on that country.
Well, I also think that the other thing, which is a hidden agenda, is that I think I would say maybe it's not too much of the canal. I think the Reagan administration is worried sick that they allowed the Contras to run drugs to raise money for their Contras. They allowed Noriega to run drugs and raise money. Now the U.S. Senate and U.S. Congress is beginning to look into the drugs. You know, how come drugs can flow here? And I think the Reagan administration knows that pretty soon they are going to lay their hands on, Congress is going to lay its hands on concrete evidence on how Noriega and the Contras were key in pumping drugs. And you know, so what they are trying to do is prevention. And you know, if we charge Noriega and we try and look, if they really wanted to apply sanctions on Panama, they could. I mean they wanted on Nicaragua, they did a great job. But I think it's because they just want to keep the confusion going, because Noriega has done more than half of the things they've told us. And I think it's a very preemption thing.
Another idea of policy, I wonder what would happen to the United States government if you would have just 10% of this country that did not like the U.S. policy stop paying taxes.
Well, they can throw you in jail because
unless
you do it en masse. I mean, we've had people suggest that and say, you know, well, maybe, but
I don't think they have that many jails.
Oh yeah, but I don't think you have that many people who won't pay taxes.
I don't think we have that many people willing to put their neck out.
Yeah. Well, I think they already have tons of people who are not paying taxes to start with. And, you know, so you really can't add too much to the coke.
Have them stop drinking coke.
I'm sorry.
Stop drinking coke.
Well, okay, I get a lot. And listen to this: the folks who oppose us will try and make you sound like you're not well put up together, as they say in Brooklyn. They say you're not bound too tight upstairs. And you know, they'll make you sound like that because they'll say, well, if you don't like it in South Africa, stop riding a Ford or stop drinking Coca-Cola and whatever. Sure, we could do that, those things. But the big thing is that if you take this church, and I know you might not like this, but we make an example. If you take this church is millions of dollars out there. It's more, look, I can stop drinking Coke from down here, the snack bar, but if we could get the church to do it, it has a much bigger impact than the Coke out there. So it's not because we don't stop drinking Coke. We are making a choice. We are going for the most effective impact that we can get. And so don't allow them to make you feel guilty and say, oh, you know, if you're really serious, why are you sitting here and eating this or drinking that or not drinking that? They will try and make you look ridiculous because, I mean, that's a form of defense. I mean, we know where the big money is, and that's the money we want. And, you know, that's the money they should get. And we're not saying anybody should lose his pension. $50 billion has been divested, and some of it is being divested as we speak by more than 25 states, and oh, there are many folks from Minnesota here, right? Hey, Minnesota. You know, you probably don't even know that the investment, what's the name of it? I came there and testified one day when it was so cold, I thought I would die. But I came there, the state pension investing people, they have pulled out $2 billion out of Sarah quietly. And I mean, are the lights too dim in Minneapolis today? I mean, has the country for state fallen apart? I mean, the point is that it can be done prudently by law. And people say, what do you want to achieve with sanctions? Well, you know, look, it's very easy to argue what won't work. Be willing to say what will work. See, everybody likes to stand up and say, oh, you know, man, oh, God, your game plan is not real. You know, your scheme you have, it's not going to work. Hey, look, anybody can say that, but be willing to say what will work. I am saying South Africa is on the verge of blowing up, and I would rather die knowing I tried to do something rather than sit back. And the thing we can do, and that's why I gave you this question and answers on that, you hear other people who are more qualified than me. It's not because we are dumb, we don't know what's going to happen. They all say it here, and they say the same thing about Namibia. And you know, if you were to choose what you could do, this is the sanctions is the way out. Hey, listen, when we had to get rid of Hitler, they drafted people to go fight there, right? Did anybody sit down and say, okay, Mr. Hitler, come to the table. Could you please stop killing Jewish people? I mean, anyway. Anybody else? Speak up, because we don't see it now.
Tell me if I kind of understand your message. This is what I think I'm hearing. And that... taking last night's discussion into account.
Taking what?
Last night's discussion into account and what we've heard.
Well, we'll explain what's last night.
Well, anyway, is it your hope that if the United States and, say, Great Britain and the other major nations that are into South Africa for their armed bids, if they begin to divest and the multinationals, that it will weaken the South African government enough that it will reduce the amount of bloodshed that is going to be necessary for the blacks to...
Oh, sure, because the South African government, look at it this way. For a government to survive, okay, just think of any country. Let's call that country X. And we're not going to say whether it's in Africa or in North America or whatever. We're just going to call it X, country X. For country X to survive, they need what? Money. Right? Hell, it's good if you have computers, because at least you can keep track of everybody quickly, right? And you know, you need cars, so the government folks can ride home. So if you need cars, you need oil, because you need to drive. But these are the four things. South Africa raises $3 to $4 billion a year on loans from the United States and Europe. Now, the reason why it's very important for your pension fund to take a policy that says we do not invest in South Africa is because this $3-4 billion is the money that comes from pension funds. Not all of us are gonna retire tomorrow, right? wait a minute, let me put it this. Are you aware that banks don't have money? You know, sometimes you go to the bank and take off your hat like we do in South Africa and crumble it and say, please give me a loan. It's not their money. No bank starts off with money. It's your money. So the banks take your pension money. And what do? They want to make money off your money, right? They give a loan to South Africa.
It's a hell of a poor investment, isn't it?
Eh?
It's a hell of a poor investment.
Oh, yeah.
That money's going to be gone.
Well, yeah. In fact, if you want to talk fiduciary responsibility, we are arguing now, we're trying to get smart lawyers to go to court. I'm a union member, no. Some folks might not like unions, but I'm an old union member. We are trying to go to court to argue that fiduciary responsibility says you can't put money in Beirut because Beirut is falling apart, right? You can't put money in a neighborhood that's falling apart, because if you do that, it's not being prudent. There's a law called, or a clause called, a prudent man rule, which means only men can be prudent, right? But anyway, it's called the prudent man rule. That says you invest prudently. And it's not prudent, as defined by law, to put money there. But what do they? They use your pension money. And that's why it's important for New York City to say, our $12 billion, you can't take it out. Because that's the money they gave to the dictators, you know, who make those, you know, the loans they write off. And you know, because nobody can pay, where does that money come from? It comes from these pension funds, so it's very important. Computers, where do they come from? They come from the U.S. So, to be very brief, I am saying that if you were to get the U.S., Britain, Germany, Japan, just mentioned for France, to cut off these things, South Africa couldn't survive. In fact, the South African government says so. I'm not saying it. They can survive. And I think, to me, this is the most peaceful method. When people ask me, can there be a peaceful method? Because otherwise, whether we like it or not, it's bad arithmetic, to repeat what we said last night, that 4 million whites can continually oppress 26 million people. It's bad arithmetic. Because if black people wanted to kill white people, there won't be enough whites to go around. There won't be enough to go around. And you know, I would rather not go for this because, you know, I am not convinced that after you kill a lot of people, you suddenly are struck by the grace of God. I mean, I'm not too sure about that. But at the same time, I'm not going to lie to you and say it's not going to happen. So that's why we opt for this. It's not perfect. People say, well, sanctions don't work. Sanctions are never going to be perfect. You know why they won't be perfect? I sat down with the chairman, with the vice president of Chemical Bank. He said, look, Kumar, if Germany wants $1 billion, they say on a computer, you know, send $1 billion at 5%, and it comes up in this guy's office, and this guy says, yes, money on the line, presses a button, $1 billion is gone in 30 seconds. And, you know, and so, you know, there's so much money going up and down. Even Reagan doesn't know. Well, he doesn't know too many things. But the point is that there is so much money going. It's never going to be perfect. But it is. Look, some of you folks come from states where people want to hang people. I don't believe in the death penalty. But you find these people who say, if we hang them, we'll be safe. In those states, there's still murder. The laws of murder are not perfect. But the laws are there so that we can prosecute those who take other people's lives, right? And it's the same thing. These sanctions are not going to be perfect, but God knows we can prosecute them for breaking the sanctions. Yeah, so please.
Yeah. Another thing on what you were saying, you take, for instance, with the miners' strike in South Africa, when the miners strike.
Oh, great, yes. Good point.
For 3 weeks, they sat home. They first said they wanted a 30% increment on their pay. And the government and the industry said no, no deal. 3 weeks later, South African economy was shambles. Just with one component, the miners. And the industry was quick. It fired some people, but it was quick to offer the miners 25% from 30%. It didn't even take 2 hours to negotiate that, please go back to work, here's your 25%. And they started from zero. Nothing you're going to get from us, we're going to fire all of you. to retool or re-educate or retrain, it costs money, so they didn't want to go for that. Mm-hmm. So they gave them 25%.
Oh, yeah.
So like what we're saying, you take some, for one, the university I went to, they were having heavy investments, and one time I happened to go to one of my professor's office, and he had all this bunch of studies. He went to South Africa that summer. And all this time, this man has been going to South Africa, and every time I'm in his office, oh, I'm fascinated about South Africa, I want to go there. Meanwhile, he knows he does these jobs as consulting for the South African government through the United States on the education level. So all these things come into place. And then the other thing is when Reagan came in, blacks who were living in South Africa, either as displaced people or for educational opportunities. When Reagan came, all the things, the flood of students coming, stopped, and there was no more funding. So like what Dumisani is saying, if we can cut off, everybody can divest, South Africa will be on its knees within maybe 6 months.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing, this is very important, I'll repeat it twice. Are you aware that black people inside South Africa are already applying sanctions against the government? We are applying sanctions on our own. So we're not just sitting and waiting for you to come saving us. There's what is known as a rent strike in South Africa. Now, you have to understand, in South Africa, the only landlord allowed is the government. There's only one landlord. You can't rent a house from Mr. Jones. It's illegal. There's only one landlord, it's the government. Black people in South Africa facing eviction, you saw it on TV, and are refusing to pay rent. It's costing the South African government $2 million a day. And you know, because people are saying, we are not going to give you our money to try and oppress us. When the mine workers stayed home, they stayed home because they said, we are going to cut money from you. When there's been these worker strikes. So, people inside are already taking sanctions. And they are saying, help us take sanctions. And then you guys sit here and say, we know what's good for you. You will suffer, you will lose your job. You see what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
Anyway.
To elaborate on that, like you, now and then you see people saying, we're not going to buy from white establishments.
Yes.
No,
yes,
groceries or anything at certain periods of the year that are going to come in here. You're going to buy black, is going to stay here. Many white businesses shut down.
Oh, yeah.
And they, the very same businessmen, turn against the government to try and negotiate with the people themselves.
Oh, yeah. It's happening right now. See? It's happening right now. Anyway.
How many times have black strikes been widespread in South Africa?
Many times. But I'll tell you what. There are lessons, the way I will put it. There are lessons that we learn as human beings that are not taught at Harvard or Yale and what have you, that we have to learn from experience. I mean, sort of like the gospel, we have to go through the cross, right? No matter you go to seminary, they tell you until you go through the cross, that's only then you know it. What happens is that, the reason I'm saying that is because then there have been these many strikes, there have been these many phases of striking. Then people say, well, why don't they just stay home for a month or 2 months, and you know, or whatever, or 10 days or a week, so that you know they can bring their families too. My father, when my father stayed home, this was way back in 1960, and you know, there was a 3-day strike. There were six of us then, and my father earned $10 a week to feed six of us. And it meant that by staying home for 3 days, he sacrificed more than half of his wages. So that week we had $5. But he stayed home because he said, it's a matter of dignity. He said, if I don't teach you, my children, that you can stand up for dignity, you are going to be umuntu waluto, which means a worthless person. I mean, if you can't stand up. So, you know, the thing is that people have had to do it in phases, because it's also a matter of survival. It doesn't mean that they love their jobs more than they love freedom. It's just that it's all in the way of ministering to whites, if you can imagine that. Ministering to whites, say, hey, we don't like what's happening. You know, we can stay home. we can do this. Unfortunately, to the government, you know, they don't understand that. I mean, each time they stay home for 3 days, the government says, oh, thank God, they didn't stay for four. And, you know, if they stay home for 4 days, oh, thank God, they didn't stay for five. I mean, they just miss the message altogether. But those are sanctions. Those people who really have next to nothing are saying we are taking sanctions on our own. Anyway, we have to stop because I have to sing with a Holden Heaven is Unified.